Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on global warming when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. And unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Now, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. It's about 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on. And the sea has not increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that all possible? Well, we call it the circle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds, and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in this modern science of meteorology, we understand that. Now, modern science has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago, and that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And this is one of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we conduct here twice a year at the law school. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about global warming. Global warming is about as phony as a $3 Federal Reserve note. At least global warming, for the purposes that it's being propagandized and it's being disseminated, is phony. I wouldn't argue with you that the world is warming up or cooling off. That's been going on historically for literally thousands of years. In fact, I showed you in the last program that the temperature variations have been as much as 3 to 8 degrees centigrade in historic times. I mean, it's been written down, for crying out loud. Written down in the last 500 years. So when scientists tell you that, oh my God, we could have a 2 to 3 degree temperature rise over the next 100 years, okay, so what else is new? It's already happened, and the world didn't come to an end the last time or the time before that, when it rose by 2 or 3 times more than the doomsayers are telling us that it's going to occur in the next 100 years. But remember, I told you that keep your eye on the ball, and here's where the ball is. The ball is a dollar a gallon carbon tax. That's what we're after. Now, in order to do that, we have to persuade you. And I pointed out last time, I said, well, you know, they persuaded us that we needed to go to war against Afghanistan. Now, this is the crazy part of this war. 20 Saudi Arabians attack us, and we go to war against Afghanistan and Iraq. What would happen if Russia attacked us? Would we go to war against Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay? I mean, God, you know, there's got to be reason, logic, and common sense somewhere that connects these dots, don't you think? I mean, if I was in a bar and some guy come up and punched me in the nose, what would I do? Turn around and punch somebody else in the nose? Or would I want to punch the guy that punched me in the nose? I mean, my common sense says, you know, keep your mind focused on the enemy. And so they got our minds focused on this phantom terrorist, Osama bin Laden. And you're over here killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. Okay, now there's a reason for that, and I'm not going to get off into that one, you know, but we got the same thing here with this global warming. Now, there's a reason for this global warming propaganda going on out here, you know, with Scott Pelley and 60 Minutes and Katie Couric and CBS Evening News and Brian Williams and all these guys, you know, they're telling us about this. We're reading about it in the newspapers, one thing and another. And now they're calling us global warming deniers. Well, before you hang that label on me, I'm not denying that the world's getting warmer. I'm just saying, well, so what? So what? Now, there was a scientist, I think it was Edward Teller. I'm not quite sure if it was Edward Teller, Linus Pauling, or somebody else, but when this global warming thing came up, he said, now listen, you got global warming, and they say it's caused by carbon dioxide gas. Now, that's preposterous on its face. Carbon dioxide gas is a beneficial gas that benefits plant life. It'd be like saying, oh my God, we're putting oxygen into the air. Well, okay, but oxygen is a beneficial gas. You know, if we were putting carbon monoxide into the air, or if we were putting something else into the air, maybe they'd have something to argue about. But when you're putting carbon dioxide into the air, that's a beneficial gas to all plant life on the planet, which is ultimately beneficial to all animal life on the planet. That's a good gas. Nothing wrong with it. The more, the better. In fact, in historic times, there has been more in the atmosphere. Going back to Adam and Eve in the first world before the flood, they had a whole lot more carbon dioxide in the air. Well, anyway, Edward Teller came up with a novel conclusion to this. I'm going to give Teller the credit, maybe some of the scientists here, but he said, what you do is you go up into the atmosphere with big jet airplanes and you spread particles. You know, kind of like what they're doing already, except instead of spreading protozoa and cancer-causing chemicals that kill us and harm us, just spread dust. And then the sun's rays will hit the dust, bounce back into the atmosphere, or out of the atmosphere, back into space, and it will cool the Earth off. Now, that sounds kind of science fiction-y and Buck Rogers-ish, and he estimated that it would cost $2 billion a year, every year that you want to do this, and you could cool the Earth off by about 2 degrees every year that you do that. So I got to looking at that, and I said, well, is there any merit to that? And the answer is, you bet there is. In fact, that's already been done. Now, we didn't do it with jet airplanes, but it was done by volcanic activity. Now, listen to this. Throughout the Little Ice Age, the world also experienced heightened volcanic activity. When a volcano erupts, its ash reaches high up into the atmosphere, and it can spread to cover the whole Earth. Let me repeat that. It can cover the whole Earth. This ash cloud blocks out some of the incoming solar radiation, leading to worldwide cooling that can last up to 2 years after an eruption. Also emitted by eruptions is sulfur in the form of SO2 gas, and when this gas reaches the stratosphere, it turns into sulfuric acid particles, which reflect the sun's rays, further reducing the amount of radiation reaching the Earth's surface. The 1815 eruption of Tambora in Indonesia blanketed the atmosphere with ash. The following year, 1816, came to be known as the year without a summer, when frost and snow were reported in June and July in both New England and Northern Europe. Now, 1815, boys and girls, is historic times here in the United States of America. Remember, the War of 1812 lasted 1812, 1813, 1814. The very next year, 1815, Tambora in Indonesia erupted. And in 1815, we had a year, or 1816 rather, 1816 was the year without a summer in New England here in the United States. Notice now that this ash can circle the Earth and it can cool it off. All right, so Dr. Edward Teller's concepts aren't, you know, I don't know whether you could get 10 airplanes to do this or 50. He estimated $2 billion. I don't know, maybe. I mean, if we did absolutely nothing, you can rest assured that the God of creation will take care of it for us. When I listen to Al Gore and the preposterous presumptions that he believes, I guess he believes his own press releases, that we can alter the weather here on planet Earth and that we need to do this and we need to do it in the name of science. You know, I got to sit here and shake my head and say, this guy actually believes that he's a god, for crying out loud. Now, so far, we haven't been able to control volcanoes. So far, we have not been able to control the weather. I'm sure that our military is out working hard to try to do just that. There isn't anything that I can think of that we haven't done, that we haven't screwed up, or that we have done that we haven't screwed up. Let me read you a story here from the encyclopedia. This is from the bicentennial edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, reporting on a volcano called Krakatoa. This occurred back in 1883. Now, that's pretty historic times. 1883, here in the United States of America. It was after the Civil War by about 20 years. And you know, we're building railroads and we're building America. We've still got buffalo running around on the prairies and we're building railroads across the continent. And a volcano over in Indonesia erupted. And it affected the United States of America. It infected the entire world. It's called Krakatoa. The volcano on Puleo Island in the Strait of Sunda between Java and Sumatra, Indonesia, its eruption in 1883 was one of the most catastrophic witnessed by man. Sometime within the last 1 million years, the volcano built a cone-shaped mountain composed of flows of volcanic rock altering with layers of cinder and ash. From its base, 1,000 feet below sea level, the cone projected about 6,000 feet above sea level. Later, the mountain's top was destroyed to form a caldera, or crater, and portions of the caldera projected above the water as four small islands. On the northwest, Lang and the Polish Hat on the northeast, and at Rataga on the south-southwest, and over the years, three new cones were formed, merging into a single island. The highest of the three cones rose about 2,667 feet above sea level. Now, the only known eruption prior to 1883 occurred in 1680. It was only moderate. On May 20th, 1883, one of the cones again became active. Ash-laden clouds reached a height of 6 miles, and explosions were heard in Jakarta, 100 miles away. But by the end of May, the activity had died down, and it resumed on June 19th and became paroxysmal, whatever paroxysmal is, by August the 26th. And at 1 p.m. on that date, the first of a series of increasingly violent explosions occurred. And at 2 p.m., a black cloud of ash rose 17 miles above Krakatoa. The climax was reached at 10 o'clock on August 27th, when a tremendous explosion was heard, 2,200 miles away in Australia, and propelled ash to a height of 50 miles. Pressure waves in the atmosphere were recorded around the Earth. Explosions diminished throughout the day, and by the morning of August 28th, the volcano was quiet. Small eruptions continued in the following months and in February of 1884. The discharge of Krakatoa threw into the air nearly 5 cubic miles of rock fragments, and large quantities of ash fell over 300,000 square miles. Near the volcano, masses of floating pumice were so thick as to halt ships. The surrounding region was plunged into darkness for 2.5 days because of ash in the air. The fine dust drifted several times around the earth, causing spectacular red sunsets throughout the following year. After the explosion, only 2,667-foot high islet remained in a basin covered by 900 feet of ocean water. As much as 200 feet of ash and pumice fragments had accumulated on Veriton and Long Islands and the remaining southern part of Rataka or Rakata. Analysis of this material revealed that very little of it consisted of debris from the former central cones. The fragments of old rock in it represented less than 10% of the volume of the missing part of the island. Most of the material was new magma brought up from the depths of the earth, and most of it distended into pumice by expansion of the gas it contained or completely blown apart to form ash. Thus, the former volcanic cones were not blown into the air, as was first believed, but instead they sank out of sight as the top of the volcano collapsed because of the removal of a large volume of magma from the underlying reservoir. The volcano's collapse triggered a series of tsunamis or tidal waves recorded as far away as South America and Hawaii. The greatest wave, which reached a height of 120 feet and took 36,000 lives in nearby coastal towns of Java and Sumatra, occurred just after the climactic explosion. All life on the Krakatoa Island group was buried under a thick layer of sterile ash, and reestablishment of plant and animal life did not begin for 5 years. Krakatoa was quiet until 1927 thereafter. Now here's the point that I wanted to make with that article. It comes from the encyclopedia. That volcano affected weather patterns around the world for the next 2 or 3 years. And that's because of that ash layer that was put up into the atmosphere. And so Dr. Teller wasn't whistling Dixie when he said, you know, if we went up there and we spread a particle layer over the atmosphere, it will bounce the sun's ultraviolet rays back into the back out into space, and it will have a cooling effect on the earth. If Al Gore and the gang actually wanted to cool off the earth, you don't have to shut down the coal-fired power plants to do that. And we've had experience with volcanoes, and we can do the same thing. And Teller suggests that we can do it for about $2 billion a year, which is a hell of a lot less than $252 billion every year that we're all going to end up paying now with this new carbon tax. Now keep your eyes on the ball here, boys and girls. Carbon tax, that's what they're after. All right, now that's called the Little Ice Age. That kind of wraps that one up. Now there's another little part of a story here from a scientist in France. Interesting little part of it. He's a former global warming advocate who, after he evidently finished and retired or whatever, changed sides. He's from France, and he's one of the more active, one of the more prestigious or personalities in the controversy here. This is the story, Environment and Public Works. One of the most decorated French geophysicists has converted from a believer in man-made catastrophic global warming to a climate skeptic. This latest defector from the global warming camp caps a year in which numerous scientific studies have bolstered the claims of climate skeptics. Scientific studies that debunk the dire predictions of human-caused global warming have continued to accumulate, and many believe the new science is shattering the media-promoted scientific consensus on climate alarmism. Claude Allègre, a former government official and active member of France's Socialist Party, wrote an editorial on September 21, 2006 in the French newspaper L'Express, titled The Snows of Kilimanjaro, detailing his newfound skepticism about man-made global warming. Alegre wrote that the cause of climate change remains unknown and pointed out that Kilimanjaro is not losing snow due to global warming, but to local land use and precipitation changes. Alegre also pointed out that studies show that Antarctic snowfall rate has been stable over the past 30 years, and the continent is actually gaining ice. Now, Scott Pelley, if it wasn't Scott, then it was that woman from CBS. What the hell is her name now? She's kind of famous. I can't think of her name. Anyway, they sent her down there to Antarctica. And she reported back that the snowfall down there was in decline and that the ice was melting in Antarctica. And if it continues on, the penguins are all going to die. And so they brought the little penguins out there and they shot pictures of the penguins and said, oh, my God, they're declining. I don't know. Hell, maybe they are. You got to remember that oftentimes they tell you the truth. Now, there's a story in here about a guy that's up in the northern regions up in Canada around Hudson's Bay. And he said, contrary to the reports that you're receiving, the polar bears are not dying out because of global warming, and they are not becoming extinct, nor are they even threatened. Now, he's a scientist that studies polar bears, and he says there's 13 groups of polar bears in Canada. 13. He said 11 of them are increasing, and 2 of them are decreasing in populations based upon local factors. So I look at these conflicting reports, and the reports that are coming in are true reports. For instance, I saw this report myself, watching the news one night, and here comes Katie's correspondent, and they report from a scientist up there, yes, the polar bears are declining, and if it continues on this way, they'll become extinct. All right, now I saw that, and that's probably a true report. Of the 13 groups of polar bears in Canada, and there's other groups of polar bears in Siberia and in Alaska, so Canada is not the only place, but there are 2 groups of polar bears in Canada that are in decline, and let's accept that as a true report. But 13 is the total number, and 11 of them are increasing in numbers. So if the increase is equal to the decrease, then we're actually ending up with more polar bears. If it isn't, then it's about the same, and nothing has changed. But the purpose behind the decrease in the 2 groups of polar bears is to promote global warming, and we've got to do something about that. So they're not giving you the whole story. Now, this, again, is that deception by omission. So they tell you the truth, that polar bears are declining. Well, that's okay, that's true, in 2 groups. Then they don't tell you anything about polar bears are increasing in 11 groups. They don't report about the polar bears in Siberia or Alaska at all. Well, how about the polar bears in Siberia? Are they decreasing? How many groups are they? How about Alaska? How many groups of polar bears in Alaska? And how many of them are increasing? How many of them are decreasing? How many polar bears are there in a group? I don't know. And when I say I don't know, well, then how in the hell can we make an evaluation and make a determination or make a decision on insufficient facts? Now, when we go to court, we say, well, he's drawing conclusions from insufficient facts. To draw a conclusion that global warming is wiping out the polar bears is inconclusive. We don't have enough facts to make that determination. And furthermore, it isn't worldwide. It's only in Canada. They didn't report. Now, you can rest assured that if there was a decline in polar bear population in Siberia, they'd be over there to report on it. If there was a decline in Alaska, they'd be there to report on it. So there's 2 groups of polar bears around Hudson's Bay that are in decline. The scientists there say, we don't know. We don't know why they're in decline. And so then somebody, well, it must be global warming then. We don't know if it's global warming or if they're getting poisoned by mercury or if they're being poisoned or if they're dying for some other reason. We don't know. It's inconclusive. Now, I'm not here to take sides one way or the other. I'm just here to make a report, and I reported to you last time, that we got a friend here and a guy by the name of John Swinton, who as a fellow journalist, he said, you know, we are tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents and our possibilities and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, I never denied being a whore, but I thought maybe I'd repent of that and come on here and say, well, let me tell you from my perspective over here that some of what you're hearing is the truth and some of what you're hearing is a damn lie. Some of it's just an ordinary lie, but all of it's propaganda. And all of it taken together, global warming is just propaganda. But it's not propaganda for no good purpose. I pointed out last time, these scientists that are working out here, they have to have a job, and their job is going to come from government. You can rest assured that Bill Gates isn't going out here hiring paleontologists and climatologists. He doesn't have any need for those kind of people. And so the government has a need for those kind of people. And so they go out and they make studies. And then when we come up with a policy, when we come up with some kind of a new idea, we can call upon these scientists. These paid professional whores, scientists, paid professional whores, to give us the report that we want. Now, let me give you an illustration. I've reported on this more than once. Let me tell you once more. The John Deere people back in the 1950s came up with a novel new idea. It's called a field chop. The idea was, when cows go out into a pasture, they eat about half the grass and they mess up the other half. Well, wouldn't it be good if we could go out into the field and get 100% of it? So it said, well, what we'll do is this. We'll go out with a field chopper, chop this stuff, put it in a wagon, haul it up, put it in feed bunks, and let the cows eat it out of the feed bunks. By doing it that way, we get 100% efficiency. Sounds real good. Makes all the sense in the world. So they go to the University of California at Davis and they say, here, try this thing out and tell us how it works. And they paid them about $3 million, which back in 1956, you know, or 54 or something, is a lot of money. And so predictably, the professors and the students, when they went out and tested this machinery with their $3 million grant, came up with a favorable report, and John Deere went out and they sold these machines like crazy all over the United States. Now, after the farmers bought the machines, based upon the slick brochures and everything else, they got to putting two and two together and found out that it was actually costing them more money than letting the cows waste half of the grass out in the field. And they had to work real hard to lose money on top of it. And so chopping now is passe. Nobody does it anymore. Well, I shouldn't say nobody does it anymore. They're still chopping for silage and one thing or another. But, you know, by and large, they gave up on it. They quit because it wasn't profitable. But the report from the university said it was profitable. Now, those people at the university dummied up that report. Why did they do that? Because they got paid to. That's why. And hell, all of those university professors are scientists. That's what a scientist is. He's a knowledgeist. Science is knowledge. He's a knowledgeist. He's a guy that's out here working hard to develop new knowledge and write it down so the rest of us will know this new knowledge. But not all new knowledge is necessarily profitable or beneficial for humanity. I mean, we got nuclear bombs. Tell me that that's beneficial for humanity. Huh? Huh? Come on, kids. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling 417-273-4967. Just ask for the number again. It's 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about global warming. Global warming is as phony as a $3 bill. Well, at least the projections that are being forecast for it. This thing of global warming has gone on in the past. It's a historic phenomenon that goes on from time to time. Over the past 1,500 years, there's a 1,500-year climate cycle. Let me describe that for you. The existence of climatic changes, possibly on a quasi 1,500-year cycle, is well established for the last glacial period from ice cores. Less well established is the continuation of these cycles into the Holocene, H-O-L-O-C-E-N-E. I haven't got a clue as to what a Holocene is. More controversially, some global warming skeptics have used the 1,500-year climate cycle to argue against current anthropogenic global warming, but the hypothesis itself exists independent of political considerations. Political considerations. Oh my God. Let me underline that. There are political considerations here, boys and girls. Now, one publication outlining this view was the November 1997 article called A Pervasive Millennial Scale Cycle in North Atlantic Holocene and Glacial Climates, published in the journal Science and authored by 10 climatologists and climate modelers, where they argue for a 1,500-year climate cycle in the North Atlantic region. All right. Well, I'm not going to get into all the details. It's well documented here. The references that they've got here in this article is one to five books. This is retrieved from Wikipedia. This is where we got the information. Remember, wikipedia.org, 1,500-year climate cycle. All right. Now, it's been pretty well established, I think everybody's in agreement with this, that climate changes. And it's been changing, and these guys think that it's over the last 1,500 years. I think that probably, God himself intervenes in the climate. He tells us that in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. He says, I'll give you rain in due season if you do what I tell you. He says, I'll give you a drought and all kinds of problems if you don't. Well, then that indicates that he's got to have the power to do that. You know, I'm going to give you rain in due season. I'm going to withhold the rain. Well, then he's got to have some kind of power to do that. It doesn't strike me as being too strange. You know, a guy that's able to make the sun, the universe, and the earth, and create the life forms on it strikes me as being an engineer, probably with the power to regulate and control that which he has created. The Boeing people create airplanes, and it doesn't boggle my mind to believe that the Boeing people, the engineers there, can probably regulate and control the airplanes that they've created and built. They can probably fly them, too. So I look at this and say, well, it strikes me as being reasonable to believe that a God that can create the sun can regulate and control it. He can create sunspots, which, by the way, also affects our weather. It affects things like El Niño and La Niña. You've probably heard those terms from time to time. They also have to do with hurricanes and droughts and exceedingly wet weather. It's called El Niño, the El Niño effect caused by sunspots. Now, remember, we were talking about this guy, this French scientist over here, changed camps. Did he change camps because of some new knowledge, or did he change camps because he retired? His name is Allegre. Allegre's conversion to a climate skeptic comes at a time when global warming alarmists have insisted that there is a consensus about man-made global warming. So now the proponents of global warming, they come out here, they're kind of like politicians, and they say, when I'm elected president, talk about arrogance, huh? You know, you'd think that somebody would stand up there and say, you know, I don't know whether or not I can handle the job of president. I'd like to give it a good go. And if you people out there agree with me, and if you should elect me as your president, I'll give you the best shot, and I'll give you the best job. I'll do the hardest work that I've ever done in my life, and I'll try to own up to your confidence in me. No, these arrogant SOBs, they come along and they say, oh, no. No. When I am your president, I will do thus and such and so and so. And like, I'm going to change the weather. No, I don't think so. I think these guys are whistling Dixie through a straw hat, and they got arrogance like you can't believe. Hell, they probably even believe their own press releases, but I don't. Allegre over here now, 60 scientists debunk global warming fears. 60 scientists. Well, now, I don't know if these are whores also or not. I'm just telling you that the profession of science has now turned into whoredom. Used to be, when I was a kid, we had great confidence in people that we called scientists. And after all, these were the people that discovered the atomic bomb. And you know, these are real smart people with PhDs, and they got letters after their names, and, you know, we give them a lot of respect. We presume that these people were telling us the truth and that they were honest and sincere people. Now, we find, and I read this to you more than once, that what we're dealing with here are people that will lie to you, and they just tell you very plainly. Yeah, we lie in order to sell our perspective or to sell our program. Now, people that are willing to lie to sell their program over here aren't trustworthy. Now, here are 60 scientists. I don't know if these 60 scientists are any more trustworthy than another 60 scientists on the other side of the argument. So we're not dealing with science here. We're dealing with opinion. Opinion. 60 scientists give their opinion that the world is warming because of CO2 gas. I think that's preposterous on its face, just being one plumber to another. But even if it isn't, global warming has gone on in the past. I gave you 25 reasons why global warming is a farce. And then 5 scientific reasons why global warming is stupid. At least the concept that they're trying to sell. And what they're selling here, remember, keep your eye on the ball, is a dollar a gallon carbon tax. That's what the objective is. And if government agents over here wanted to save lives, you know, there's a lot of places where we could start to do some real good without global warming. Global warming has a payday at the end of it. And that payday is $250 billion a year. Now, that's worth going after. But anyway, the 60 scientists say this. Earlier this year, a group of prominent scientists came forward to question the so-called consensus that the Earth faces a climate emergency. On April the 6th, 2006, 60 scientists wrote a letter to the Canadian Prime Minister asserting that the science is deteriorating from underneath global warming alarmists. Observational evidence does not support today's computer climate models, so there is little reason to trust model predictions of the future. Significant scientific advances have been made since the Kyoto Protocol was created, many of which are taking us away from a concern about increasing greenhouse gases. If back in the mid-1990s we know what we know today about climate, Kyoto would almost certainly not exist, because we would have concluded it was not necessary, the 60 scientists wrote. And you can see that report in www.canada.com. Now, it was only 30 years ago that many of today's global warming alarmists were telling us that the world was in the midst of a global cooling catastrophe. But the science continued to evolve, and still does, even though so many choose to ignore it when it does not fit with predetermined political agendas, the 60 scientists concluded. Well, they've hit the nail on the head there. There's a political agenda that is attached to global warming. Now, the climate change is nothing new. In addition, an October 16, 2006, Washington Post article titled "Climate Change is Nothing New" echoed the sentiments of these 60 scientists as it detailed a new study of the Earth's climate history. The Washington Post article by reporter Christopher Lee noted that Indiana University geologist Simon Brassell found climate change occurred during the age of dinosaurs and quoted Brassell questioning the accuracy of computer climate model predictions. Well, he's right about that. The climate did change. We're not talking about millions of years, we're just talking about a few thousand. In the 1656 years between the Garden of Eden and Noah's flood, there was a climate change. At the end of the 1656 years, there was a big climate change, no doubt about it. Reported historically in the scripture. And now it's being reported scientifically from observation. Now, if there are big inherent fluctuations in the system, as paleoclimate studies are showing, it could make determining the Earth's climate future even harder than it is today. Brassell said, see www.washingtonpost.com. The article was on 10/15/2006. Global cooling on the horizon. In August, here's a guy, I couldn't pronounce his name if you paid me, but anyway, we'll call him Joe Smith. In August, Joe Smith, a scientist who heads the space research sector for the Russian Academy of Sciences, that's why I can't pronounce his name, he's a Rusky, the Academy of Sciences predicted long-term global cooling may be on the horizon due to a projected decrease in the sun's output. And you can see that on http://en.rian.ru/Russia. I guess that's Russia, the Russian web. 2006, the article appeared in August, or on August 25th, 2006. Then the sun's contribution to warming. There have also been recent findings in peer-reviewed literature over the last few years showing that the Antarctic is getting colder and the ice is growing, and a new 2006 study in Geophysical Research Letters found that the sun was responsible for up to 50% of 20th century warming. And you'll read that one on www.agu.org. Hey, I got to tell you that I saw this woman on CBS. It was NBC. NBC. I sent her down to Antarctica, and that woman was reporting that the ice was melting and threatening the penguins, for crying out loud. Saw it with my own eyeballs and heard it with my own earlobes. Now, the woman might have been reporting the truth. There could be local areas in which the penguins are dying out, just like the polar bears, in isolated groups. But the overall ice cap down in Antarctica, which we have heard reported to us constantly through the news media, is shrinking and melting, and oh my God, the end of the world is coming. No, that's not what the scientific literature is telling us. So I took the time to go get some of the scientific literature. What in the hell is the science literature telling us? They're telling us that there isn't any such event. NBC tells us that the ice cap is melting. CBS tells us the ice cap is melting, but not the scientific literature. Not the scientists are on the spot, on the job, down there, making the day-to-day calculations and observations and reading. That's not what they're reporting at all. So I got to sit here as a reporter and say, well, wait a minute. Somebody's lying. Somebody ain't telling the truth here. And then, you know, just from my perspective here, I can't tell you who's telling the truth and who isn't, but I'm highly suspicious, especially when I see that there's a $250 billion carbon tax at the end of global warming. Now, that tells me a whole lot about who's lying. Hell, for $250 billion, I'd lie. I'll tell you a little story here. One time, there was a guy who sent me some money in the mail. It was $35,000, $350 bills, to be exact. $35,000, sent it in the mail, $100 bills. When my secretary brought it in to me, I could smell it. Money has a smell. You could smell it right through the envelope. So when she handed me the envelope, I said, hell, this thing's got money in it. Can you smell it? I opened it up and counted it all out, put it on the table over there, and I said, oh, my God. I called this guy on the telephone. Hey, I saw his letter in there. He sent it in. He wanted to convert it to gold, so he wanted to do it. In the old days, I used to do that. Don't send me any money now because I don't do that. I used to. I don't anymore. So the upshot of it was I called this guy on the phone, and I said, you blind, you fool, you nitwit. And by the way, sent it ordinary mail. He didn't even send it. He didn't even send it registered or insured. And I said, the only reason that that package got here is because every postal employee that picked that up could smell the money in it. But you see, the postal employees, they're not dumb, you know. They all know that they're being monitored, and they know that they got cameras on them all the time. And you could just rest assured that every one of them smelled that money, and they said, oh, this is a trap. The Postal Inspection Service is trying to catch me stealing this package. And so you can be sure that they were very careful as they picked it up and dropped it into the next mail sack. See? So it comes to me, and I'm sitting here with it, and I call this old, he was an old man, and he says, well, I trust you, Mr. Gordon. And I said, well, you're a damn fool, and that's because I'm a thief. But my price is higher than $35,000. Now, an old buddy of mine, an old gold broker buddy, said, George, you never want to risk more than you can afford to lose. I always tuck that one away in my heart. Never risk more than you can afford to lose. And he also told me, he said, every man has a price. Every man has a price. And I told that to this old fella, and then I said, you know, I'm a thief, and I've got a price. I don't know what my price is. $35,000 isn't my price. I'm not going to steal your $35,000, but I said, for God's sake, don't send me $350,000, because that might test me beyond my capacity. And you can rest assured that for $3,500,000, you will have hit my price. Oh, my God, for $250 billion, you can rest assured that you've hit my price. All right, so let's wake up and smell coffee here, kids. Every man has a price, and you tempt people beyond their ability to resist. Now, people that have never handled $35,000 in their lives, you know, they'd be highly tempted to take it. I saw a woman here the other day. She's working for the mayor's office in some little town over here. I don't know what that was. Nixon, I think it was. Nixon, Missouri. And she stole $800. $800. I looked at my wife, and I said, my God. Why in the world would this one, she's working here at a city job. Now, you know, she's making more than minimum wage. And her price was $800. Well, she probably got into some kind of little financial scrape, and she needed some money, and so she started lifting money out of the purse. Every once in a while, you'll hear about this. Normally, they're stealing $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, but this woman for $800, her price was pretty low, $800. She'd probably stole $50,000 if she hadn't got caught. Maybe she got caught early on. But here's my point. People steal very small amounts of money, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. And it's written up in the paper, and they say, well, you know, here's employee so-and-so is caught embezzling money over here and stealing money from this and stealing money from that. People steal. Well, my God, you know, politicians steal. We're talking about $250. That's a quarter of $1 trillion. They've got an agenda over here. And that agenda is going to hire a lot of scientists. It's going to pay a lot of bureaucrats. It's going to pay a lot of drones to float around in government circles over here to study the climate and study this, that, and another thing, and keep a lot of these people that are graduating from college with these PhDs employed off the streets and out of the pool halls. That's what its objective is. Well, do you and I really need that? Do we need more climatologists in some new big glass building in Washington, D.C., studying the climate or whatever the hell it is, consuming another dollar a gallon every time you fill up your tank? You know, you're paying $1 a gallon, you know, to some climate scientist over here. Do we need that? Is that the way you want to spend your money? Because that's what's coming. Global cooling on the horizon, sun's contributing to warming. Global warming stopped in 1998. Paleoclimate scientist Bob Carter has noted there is indeed a problem with global warming. It stopped in 1988, according to official temperature records of the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom. The global average temperature did not increase between 1998 and 2005. This eight-year period of temperature stasis did coincide with the society's continued power station. The SUV-inspired pumping of yet more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, noted paleoclimate researcher and geologist Bob Carter of James Cook University in Australia in April of 2006. It was an article titled, There's a Problem with Global Warming. It stopped in 1998. You can get that article at www.telegraph.co.uk. Global warming misnamed. Southern hemisphere is not warming. In addition, new NASA satellite tropospheric temperature data reveals that the southern hemisphere has not warmed in the past 25 years, contrary to global warming theory and modeling. This new southern hemisphere data raises the specter that the use of the word global in global warming may not be accurate. A more apt moniker for the past 25 years may be northern hemisphere warming. See http:// MOTLS.BLOGSPOT.com, 2006, September. Southern Hemisphere ignores global HTML. Alaska cooling. According to data released on July 14, 2006 from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, the January through June Alaska statewide average temperature was 55 degrees Fahrenheit, cooler than the 1971 to 2000 average. And you can see that article in the http://www.publicaffairs.noaa.gov. Oceans are cooling. Light hurricane season and early winter. Droughts less frequent. Global warming will not lead to next ice age. Hockey stick broken in 2006. Study shows Greenland's ice growing. Polar bears not going extinct. Remember I told you that one. Despite Time magazine, the rest of the media's unfounded hype, polar bears are not facing a crisis, according to biologist Dr. Michael Taylor from the Arctic government of Nunavut. Of the 13 populations of polar bears in Canada, 11 are stable or increasing in number. They're not going extinct. And it just goes on and on and on. That's from the scientific literature. The scientific literature says global warming is poppycock. And you can rest assured that the global warming scientists know it. So they're not just liars. As Mark Twain would say, they're a bunch of damn liars. All right, with that, I got to conclude by reminding you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.